Executive Power, Disc 7.
As Kennedy stepped off the elevator on the third floor of the executive mansion, she was prepared to do what presidential advisors had done for centuries: spin. She didn't care for the tactic, but one of her most trusted and loyal employees had put her in the awkward situation of having to do so. The alternative would be to tell the president the stark truth, which could potentially have some ramifications that she didn't need to deal with right now. The outcome of the operation was just what the president had wanted. The Andersons were safe, the United States had suffered no casualties, and a message had been sent to the terrorists. Using Rapp's line of logic, or defense, as Kennedy was more inclined to say, it didn't much matter how they got there, just so long as they got there. Kennedy entered the fitness room and, after sidestepping a weight bench, approached the president, who was hunched over the console of a stair-stepper. Hayes tore his eyes off one of three TVs mounted on the wall in front of him. He'd seen Kennedy enter the room in the reflection of the mirrored wall. With sweat pouring from his face, he snapped, "What in the hell happened in Israel last night?" Kennedy was only momentarily caught off guard. On her way over from Langley, she'd scanned the presidential daily brief, a top-secret document compiled by the CIA that kept the president and his top national security advisors apprised of what was happening in the world. "I've already put a call into Ben Friedman, but he hasn't gotten back to me yet." The president frowned at the mere mention of Friedman's name. He was well acquainted with the head of Mossad. He, in fact, detested the man, and if it wasn't for Kennedy, the president would have demanded that Prime Minister Goldberg fire the bastard. The president wiped a film of sweat from his face with a towel and growled, "It still burns my ass that he has a job." Kennedy instantly regretted mentioning Friedman's name. The previous year he had been caught giving intelligence to and aiding one of the president's chief political adversaries. It had taken a great deal of skill to convince the president that it would be better to keep Friedman in his post and use his guilt as leverage. Hayes looked at the clock. "What time is it over there?"
"They're 7 hours ahead of us, sir. It's 2:20 in the afternoon."
"How long ago did you call him?"
"About 30 minutes ago."
Kennedy folded her arms in front of her. She'd actually put in the call about an hour ago, but saw no reason to get the president more agitated than he already was.
"Well, call him back again," snapped Hayes, "and tell him I want some answers."
Pointing at one of the TVs, he said, "They leveled an entire city block, and they're saying the death toll could surpass 100 people, for Christ's sake." Kennedy looked awkwardly at the floor and then back at the president's reflection in the mirror. He had grown considerably more irritable lately.
"Sir," she continued, "you know the Palestinians always inflate those numbers."
Hayes gripped a black bar with one hand, and with the other he lowered the speed of the machine.
"Have you seen the footage?"
he asked, a little less confrontationally.
"Yes."
"And you don't think it looks bad?"
"Yes, it does, sir, but let me get some more information before we jump to any conclusions."
Hayes nodded and began to breathe a little easier. Realizing he'd been a little hard on one of his most trusted advisors, he asked,
"So, did you have a good time last night?"
"Yes, I did. It was a very nice party, sir."
"Good." He mopped his brow again and asked, "What's happening over in the Philippines?"
Kennedy forced a smile and adjusted her glasses.
"I have good news.
The Anderson family is safely on board the Belleau Wood, as are all military personnel who participated in the operation." As if someone had delivered an unexpected gift, a mix of joy and confusion spread across the president's face. He glanced at the clock on the wall and said, "I thought the rescue wasn't set to take place for another hour or two."
"Well, there were some developments during the evening, sir, that caused us to move up our timetable."
Fortunately, Kennedy knew the president was a man who never punished success. Like most good chief executives, he delegated authority and wanted results. "A tropical storm blew in," she continued to explain, "threatening to ground our aircraft. At the same time, the rain provided the cover needed to sneak our ground forces into position earlier than we had anticipated. Not wanting to lose the opportunity, we gave the green light, and it went off without a hitch." Kennedy was tempted to mention that Rapp had been shot, but for now she wanted to keep that little nugget of information to herself. The president's face lit up.
"That's great. When will they be arriving stateside?"
The politician in him was already looking forward to greeting the family. They have to wait for the storm to break, and then they'll start back. They could be here as early as tomorrow or Monday. And how are they doing?
Fairly well, answered Kennedy. A little malnourished and covered with insect bites, but otherwise stable.
The president stopped the machine and climbed off. He moved over to a treadmill and climbed on. How are they psychologically? Hayes pressed several buttons, and the tread started moving. Kennedy could only guess at the horrors they had suffered. From her intelligence reports on other kidnappings, Abu Sayyaf and MILF were fairly humane in the sense that they seemed to avoid rape and torture, especially of Americans. But still, being held captive thousands of miles from home in extremely primitive conditions would have taken its toll.
I'm not sure, sir. For now, I bet they're just happy to be free.
Yeah, I suppose. The belt picked up speed, and the president began walking faster. He pumped his arms and said, "Do me a favor and brief Valerie on this." The president glanced at the wall clock. "She's usually in by 8 on Saturdays." The president needed his chief of staff. Kennedy understood better than most how Washington worked. Political effectiveness rose and fell with the tide of positive or negative media attention. This was too good of a story not to manage properly. Kennedy would brief Valerie Jones, and then Jones, in turn, would mobilize the formidable White House communications and press people. They would prod and squeeze this story into a 5-point jump in the polls.
Anything else, sir?
The president hesitated and then sighed. I suppose we should have the NSC meet for a full briefing. Kennedy nodded. If the president hadn't suggested it, she would have. The various cabinet-level departments needed to be brought up to speed, especially the State Department. Somebody needed to tell President Quirino in the Philippines what the United States had just done, and in light of the sensitive subject, it would be wiser if that person were the Secretary of State rather than the President.
What time would you like me to schedule it for?
Let's say 11 o'clock downstairs, and, oh, if you talk to Mitch before then, thank him for me.
Kennedy nodded.
He's an amazing man.
Kennedy did not hesitate to reply. Yes, he is.
Any man brash enough to usurp the authority of the director of the CIA, the Secretary of Defense, and the President, all in one evening, was an amazing man, indeed.
Chapter 42.
Trust was a word that David wasn't very fond of at the moment. Ben Friedman had broken their agreement. There could be little doubt, based on the news reports, that the head of Mossad had wanted his newest informant to die in the attack that had taken place on the previous eve. Extending that logic and understanding the brutality that Friedman was known for, David felt the need to get out of Israel as quickly as possible. After stumbling away from the site of the bombing, David didn't make it far, only 2 blocks to be precise. A ruptured eardrum caused him to walk as if he were drunk. His dust-covered suit, listless walk, and bloodied face caught the attention of a paramedic who, after a quick examination, thrust him into a waiting ambulance. Upon arrival at the hospital, David gave a fake name. Mossad had spies everywhere, and if they weren't lucky enough to have one at the hospital, they could hack into the patient files with little effort. One of the first people to arrive after the attack, he was treated right away. The gash in his leg and neck were cleaned and stitched up with great speed. More seriously injured people were being pulled from the rubble and on their way. Having grown up around hospitals, David had no problem finding the doctor's lounge. He moved without fear of being discovered. The staff would be working at a crisis pace for the next day or more. His clothes were no longer useful, so he threw them into the garbage and cleaned up. The only thing he kept were his undergarments, shoes, and a money belt that contained cash and documents for an assumed identity. Next, he searched the lockers until he found one that contained clothes roughly his size. David changed into them and took the car keys sitting on the top shelf. Out in the parking garage, he went to the first level where the physician's parking was located, and hit the door lock button on the keyless entry twice. Up ahead on his right, a pair of headlights flashed and a horn honked. David left Hebron as directly as possible. Various Palestinian groups had already begun setting up barricades to keep the Israeli Defense Forces from entering the city, and he was lucky to find a way through them. By sunup, David had made it all the way to the south and crossed the border into Jordan at Arava. Feeling only slightly safer, he called the prince and requested that he send his plane to the seaside town of Aqaba to pick him up. The prince, comatose from a night of festivities, was unable to speak, so it was his always efficient assistant, Devon, who sent one of Omar's 5 private jets. By noon, he was safely out of Friedman's reach and on his way to France. He landed in Nice in mid-afternoon and was taken by limo to the Carlton Hotel in Cannes, where Devon had booked him a suite. The first order of business was clothing, so after an hour of shopping along De La Croisette and billing everything to his hotel room, and ultimately the prince, David returned to the solitude of his plush room and collapsed out of exhaustion. Some time later he was awakened by the fleshy, soft hand of none other than Prince Omar. David rolled over onto his back and tried to blink the weariness from his eyes. As the room came into focus, he realized it was nighttime. Omar reached out and pawed the side of David's neck. The touch stung the tender skin around the stitches. Out of reflex, David slapped the prince's hand away. Almost instantly he was aware of someone else in the room, someone large by the size of the shadow they cast against the wall. Chung, the obedient Chinese bodyguard, was making his presence known, lest David try anything stupid. Prince Omar, however, was not bothered by the slap. He was too amused by the mark on David's neck and the implications it held.
"I think someone has been up to something."
Omar cupped David's cheeks in his hands and said,
"I want to hear all about it."
David shooed Omar's hands away. His head was killing him, and the last thing he wanted right now was the prince touching him.
"Hear about what?" "About last night," proclaimed the Saudi prince with a twinkle in his eye.
"I don't know what you're talking about," David groaned. Omar stood up, laughing. He was dressed immaculately in a very expensive silk suit.
"Oh, you know what I'm talking about. Now get your duff out of bed and get ready for dinner."
Omar gestured with his hands toward the bathroom.
"Come now, hurry. I am very hungry, and I have been watching Al Jazeera. I want to know everything. We will eat and celebrate tonight. I will be waiting for you downstairs."
Omar, as giddy as a schoolgirl, left the room with Chung in tow. By the time he got into the shower, his spirits had lifted a bit. He was famished. Maybe a nice feast with Omar wouldn't be so bad. Shaving proved to be a bit more of a challenge than he would have liked, but with Omar, skipping it was not an option. The prince was a stickler for appearances. He wanted to be surrounded by beautiful people, and that meant well-groomed and well-dressed people. David put on his new clothes, a white shirt, 4-button black suit, and blue tie. The tie was a bit tricky, but as long as he didn't turn his head too much, it was manageable. A large, flesh-colored band-aid over his stitches helped keep blood off the collar. David found Omar downstairs in the bar. He was sitting in a corner booth, squeezed in between 4 women, 2 on each side. 2 other men sat at each end of the U-shaped booth. They were both Arab, and more than likely were several of Omar's 3,000-plus cousins. As for the women, they were undoubtedly high-priced hookers that had been secured for however long the prince chose to stay in Cannes, or until he tired of them and replacements were obtained. David almost didn't notice Chung, which was no easy feat, considering his size. Somehow he'd managed to conceal himself on the other side of a large potted fern and column. David winked at him, just to let him know he wasn't fooled. Chung's sphinx-like face remained utterly impassive. As David approached the table, Omar released his always groping hands from 2 of the girls. Reaching out, he held his palms up in a gesture of enthusiastic welcome.
"David, I am so glad you could join us."
Looking to his guests, he said with a conspiratorial wink,
"David is a man of many talents, and he is soon to be very famous."
The 2 Arab men nodded as if they knew more than they should. The girls looked at him with playful eyes and then began giggling and muttering to each other in French. David ignored the women and gave the prince a disapproving look. Omar, not wanting his little party spoiled by the often too serious David, rushed to say, "Sit!" The prince gestured to one of his cousins to make room. "Come, sit with us, we will celebrate." Looking to the waiter standing obediently near the booth, Omar yelled, "Champagne! More champagne!" David held up his arm, freezing the waiter before he could fill the order. With a smile and a slight bow at the waist, David said, "My prince, if I may have a moment of your time in private." David's forceful dark eyes conveyed that his words were not a request, but a demand.
"Of course."
Omar clapped his hands twice and gestured for the table to be removed. He was not about to slide his plump form out of the booth. The waiter snapped his fingers, and two busboys rushed over and removed the table. Omar left his guests without saying a word and grabbed David by the elbow. With a look of deep concern, he asked, "What is wrong?" David strained to look at ease. He was willing to bet double or nothing on the $10 million that Omar had given him not even a week ago, that the prince had shared their secrets with other members of the Saudi royal family. "Who are those two men?"
"Cousins, of course."
"Ah, just as I thought. And what have you told them?"
"Nothing."
David stared doubtfully at Omar. Caught in an obvious lie, Omar said,
"Nothing of consequence. I simply told them you are a great man who is changing the world, a true warrior for the Arab people."
David sighed uncomfortably. He had to have a serious conversation with Omar, but he would need his undivided attention for at least an hour. "I'm very hungry, and I need to speak with you." Omar looked back to the table.
"Good, then let's sit."
"No, not them, just the two of us." The prince looked back and forth between David and the table several times, reluctant to leave the women. Reading his mind, David said, "They can wait. You will have all night to enjoy them. All I need is 1 hour of your uninterrupted time." Omar finally agreed. After waving one of his cousins over and explaining the situation, Omar and David were led to a private table in the far corner of the restaurant. David was unsure of how to proceed. He had stressed many times how important it was to share their plans with no one. As a brother to the crown prince and high-ranking member of the Saudi royal family, Omar had always done whatever he wished. This was why David had to handle him with kid gloves. Even so, there were times when it was simply impossible not to speak his mind. As the last 24 hours had shown, this was a very dangerous game they were playing, and although it was David who was currently on the front line taking the risks, circumstances could change very quickly. If the voyeuristic prince wasn't careful, he just might end up closer to the action than he would ever wish. After choosing his words carefully, David said, "It flatters me that you say such noble things about me, but I can't stress enough that you must cease all conversation regarding our plans."
"But, David, there are people who care deeply about the cause, people who we can trust."
"People like your cousins?" asked David with a raised eyebrow.
"Of course, I trust them with my life."
David studied his benefactor. "What did you tell them?"
"I bragged about you a bit,"
Omar answered in a sheepish tone. "Did you happen to mention that I may have been involved in something that happened last night?" Omar smiled.
"Maybe."
David clutched the ornate armrests of his chair so ferociously that he thought they might snap. His mind off and running, he imagined these two ninnies pulling out their cell phones and calling their friends and family back in Saudi Arabia, bragging about their cousin and the clandestine operation he was launching to finally rid them of Israel. David never wanted to get rid of Israel. He wanted Palestine to coexist with the Zionist state, but that would never be enough for Omar and the majority of his relatives. They wanted the complete destruction of the Israeli state and the annihilation of the Jewish people. As they always did, David's thoughts returned to the phones. "My prince, I have warned you before, and it is not just to protect me, it is for your own good." David shook his head sadly. "You cannot tell people what we are doing."
I know you can trust your family, but you are missing the point. I do not think your cousins are going to run to the Americans and tell them what we are up to. No, I don't believe that for a moment. I think the Americans, however, will monitor their phone calls, and they will catch them bragging to other relatives. Omar frowned and shook his head. Impossible. The Americans do not spy on my country. David was taken completely aback by Omar's overconfidence. You do not think the Americans spy on your country?
No, answered the prince in his same confident tone. We have an agreement with them.
David stared in disbelief that someone as worldly as Omar could be so naive. I hate to break the news to you, Prince Omar, but America spies on Saudi Arabia.
They do not, David. I have spoken with my brother about the agreement, and our intelligence service monitors things very closely.
With a smug nod, he added, I can assure you. They may not have people on the ground. They may not be actively spying on you, but that does not mean they are not passively spying on you.
What do you mean, passively?
Satellites, answered David. They pick up everything. Their national security agency listens to everything. Omar seemed to think about this for a moment and then asked with a frown,
How is it possible with so many people talking on phones?
David tried not to show his shock over the prince's stupidity. Omar was not a very bright man, which, in addition to his wealth, was one of the reasons why David had picked him. He was a gambler with a very large bankroll. He had amassed his personal fortune, one separate from his family's, by getting out of real estate and into stocks at just the right time, and then vice versa, a decade later. His instincts in terms of knowing when to buy and when to sell were uncanny, but his knowledge of espionage was almost nil.
Trust me on this. They can do it. And every time you brag to one of your relatives, we have no idea how many other family members they call.
David detected a gleam in the prince's eye, and something clicked. Notoriety was the real reason for his loose lips. He had not been chosen as the crown prince, despite his financial successes, and so he now worked doubly hard to try to build his reputation within the dysfunctional House of Saud. One of the reasons he had been overlooked as a serious candidate for crown prince was his playboy lifestyle. In a country where over 90% of the residents were fervent Muslims, it was important that the king at least appear to follow the teachings of Muhammad.
Prince Omar, trust me when I tell you we do not want the Americans to find out what we are up to, or for that matter the French, the Israelis, or anyone else.
With a sour look on his face, Omar said,
I am not afraid of the Americans. They wouldn't dare touch me. My family could flush their entire economy right down the toilet.
Omar snapped his fingers contemptuously. David was tempted to point out that the Saudi royal coffers weren't what they once were. In addition, the Saudis had so much money invested in America that they would be cutting their own throats if they turned off the oil spigot. Omar was nowhere near as safe as he thought, but David would never be able to convince him of that. His life of opulence had given him a false sense of importance.
Please, don't forget, pleaded David, that the key to our success is to get the international community to think that Israel is out of control.
Omar shook his head.
The key to our plan is getting my brother to threaten America with an oil embargo. That will wake them up.
Yes, that is very important, but if you want our plan to succeed, then we need to make sure the Americans don't find out what we're up to. Grabbing his menu, Omar nodded with a frown of irritation on his face.
Enough of this talk. I thought you were hungry.
Omar gestured to the menu sitting untouched in front of David.
We will eat. And you will tell me about last night.
David grabbed the menu and glanced at the first page. Based on a conversation he had had with Omar some months earlier, he decided to make one more attempt at getting him to shut his mouth. Looking over the top of his menu, David said,
Omar,
trust no one completely, not me, and most definitely not your family. You have said it yourself that you have relatives who are far too cozy with the Americans. You know as well as I that there are people in your family, pro-Westerners, who are very jealous of your success. They would gladly sell you out to the Americans. Omar slammed his menu down, the water glasses on the table jumped, and the candle flickered.
"And what would the Americans do about it?" spat Omar. "Kill a member of the Saudi royal family? Never."
David nodded, if for no other reason than to calm the prince. His slight outburst had attracted some unwanted attention. Omar was probably right. The Americans were unlikely to assassinate him, but they might find someone else to do it. On the other hand, the Americans wouldn't think twice about killing David. David looked over his menu and decided it was best to change the subject.
"How are things with the ambassador?"
"Fine," snapped Omar. "Devon has already wired him half the money, and he will get the other half on Monday. We own him."
David was pleased to hear this. The ambassador would be a vital part of their overall plan. Things were going exceedingly well, but David knew he should temper his optimism. Hebron had worked out beyond David's wildest dreams. Friedman had overplayed his hand and now had a massacre to explain. Tomorrow, he would fly to America to carry out the next phase of the operation. It wasn't the Americans, the French, or the Israelis who were currently on the job, but the British. Alan Church's sailboat was berthed in the harbor not far from the massive yacht he'd been following for weeks. His most recent report had stirred some guarded interest back at MI6 in London. His orders were to maintain surveillance and see if he could identify the man who had met with Prince Omar. Apparently, the photographs he had snapped in Monaco were either not good enough to get a positive identification or the man was unknown. Church had been sitting at the bar, keeping an eye on the prince and his guests, when in walked the very man in whom headquarters had shown an interest. The handsome Arab spoke to the prince in a manner that suggested he was more than just another one of Omar's abundant sycophants. After a brief exchange, Prince Omar and the mysterious individual went unaccompanied to the dining room where they were seated at a remote table. A longtime follower of the Saudi royal family, Church was more familiar than most with the turmoil and tumult that bubbled just beneath the calm veneer of the very private clan. The spoiled consortium of relatives, numbering just over 5,000, sat atop a powder keg of some 23 million subjects who were growing increasingly impatient with the excesses of the ruling family. For years, the House of Saud had tried to placate religious fanatics in their country by building them lavish mosques and madrasas. The ultra-fundamentalist Wahhabi sect prospered more than any other group during this time and now held great sway and power with an increasingly unruly populace. Church was unsure if he would see it in his lifetime, but he was confident that the days of the Saudi monarchy were numbered. They had sowed the seeds of their own destruction by funding religious fanatics who would never tolerate their secular ways and gluttonous lifestyles. Omar was one such royal. Living in the lap of Western luxury, he tried to assuage his guilt by paying penance to the ultra-conservatives of a faith that he was born into, but one that he had never seriously practiced or believed in. Church informed the maitre d' that he was ready to be seated for dinner. Cannes was a town where people partied well into the night, and the evening dinner crowd was still light. The man escorted Church through the restaurant to a table that was surprisingly closer to the prince than he would have liked. Church noticed the prince's guest give him a suspicious glance. Knowing the limitations of his listening device and not wanting to raise undue suspicion, Church stopped the maitre d' and pointed to a table that was closer to the bar and farther away from the subjects. The two men reversed course and left Prince Omar and his guest to talk without fear of being heard. Sitting with his back to the wall, the British agent now had a perfectly good view of both the bar and the prince and his acquaintance. Personally, he was more interested in the four women the prince had left in the bar, but duty was duty, so he turned his attention to the matter at hand.
He retrieved a case from the breast pocket of his suit coat and donned his reading glasses. After fumbling with the case for a second, he placed it on the table with the open end pointed directly at the two men conversing in the far corner of the restaurant. With the tiny directional microphone and recorder now doing the tough work for him, Church opened the wine menu and began searching for a nice, expensive bottle of Bordeaux, courtesy of the British government. Chapter 43. Kennedy was back at Langley, sitting in her large corner office on the 7th floor. It was nearing 3 in the afternoon, and on most Saturdays she would not be in the office this late, but it was pouring outside, and her son Tommy was at a friend's house until 5. Her 7-year-old was getting more and more independent, which to Kennedy was both good and bad. Good, because he was a little less demanding of her time, and bad, because he was a little less needy of her affection. At 7, Tommy was coming out of his shell. His reserved manner had worried his teachers more than it had his mother. Others assumed it was the divorce that had caused young Thomas to be so shy, but Kennedy thought it had more to do with the fact that his mother didn't really speak for the first 5 years of her life, and to this day opened her mouth only when she really needed to. Kennedy looked at her son's shy demeanor as a positive. Just like his mother, he was very cautious around strangers, slow to anger and deeply introspective. The boy had a wonderful imagination and was capable of playing by himself for hours on end. On the other hand, he was also capable of burying his mother under an avalanche of questions when it was least expected. Now in the first grade, he was making friends, playing sports, and getting perfect marks, which was no surprise considering the IQ of his parents. While his father may not have been the most responsible and selfless man, he was nonetheless very smart. Fortunately, he didn't come around often. In Kennedy's mind, he was a distraction from an otherwise tranquil and loving home. There were other male role models around. Tommy adored Mitch, and just so happened to have a crush on his new bride. Mitch constantly prodded her son to get involved in sports and loved to take him up to Camden Yards to go watch the Orioles. Next summer, Mitch had promised to teach Tommy how to water ski. And now that she and Anna had reached an understanding, it was likely that they would see more of each other. There was also the quirky Frenchman a few doors down, Mr. Soucheray, who hung out in his garage all day listening to the radio, tinkering with an endless array of gadgets and pursuing his lifelong fascination with the internal combustion engine. Thanks to him, Tommy probably knew more about cars, motorcycles, and anything that ran on gasoline than probably any 7-year-old in the country. Kennedy closed the file on her desk and put her pen down. With a yawn, she took off her glasses and rubbed her tired eyes. If she left now, she could probably sneak in a quick nap before Tommy returned from his friend's house. She grabbed several red folders off her desk and spun her chair around. After placing the files in her safe, she locked it. She was about to get up when her large, white, secure phone rang. She looked at the display and frowned. Ben Friedman was finally returning her call almost 9 hours later. The man had gall. She possessed enough information to destroy him, and still he played these games. She was sure he would have some excuse to explain why it took him so long to call her back. Kennedy looked out at the falling rain and grabbed the handset.
Irene Kennedy. Irene, it's Ben. I'm sorry I couldn't get back to you sooner, but as I'm sure you've seen on TV, I've had my hands full over here.
Yes, we've been watching.
We took out a bomb factory last night, and now we're bracing ourselves for reprisals.
There were times when Kennedy wished she were more like Mitch Rapp. If she were, she'd tell her Israeli counterpart that he was full of shit. The news outlets were reporting that the Israeli Defense Forces attacked a bomb-making factory in Hebron, and that was why the damage was so extensive. The Palestinians were denying any such factory existed and claimed the Israelis had attacked a civilian neighborhood without provocation. The truth, as always, lay somewhere in the middle. Jake Turbis from the CTC had briefed her only an hour ago that they did not think a bomb factory was the target. They'd picked up cell phone chatter that the real target was a high-level meeting of Palestinian terrorist groups. She also had in her possession satellite imagery that showed Israeli helicopters showering the neighborhood with missiles. Ben Friedman was lying to her, but in the hall of mirrors that was her life, she wasn't about to reveal what she really knew. Instead, she simply said, "The president is very alarmed by the amount of people killed in the raid last night." In his standard defensive tone, Friedman said, "Irene, we had no idea that the secondary explosion would be so large. They had enough explosives there to level the whole block." Obviously, she thought. The latest intelligence reports indicated that the Israeli defense forces were not in control of the site. Various terrorist and militia groups around Hebron had set up roadblocks to keep the Israeli army out, and they had maintained their position just long enough for the media to show up and begin filming the carnage. The Israelis had fallen into this public relations nightmare before and immediately pulled back. Footage of tanks crushing teenagers and young men, no matter how just the cause, did not play well for the rest of the world. Friedman was playing a dangerous game here. If the Palestinians were telling the truth about the number of dead, they would have quite a case to take to the UN. When she spoke to the president, she would have to apprise him of the possibility. No sense going too far out on a limb to defend Israel if they weren't going to tell the truth to their best ally. She decided to prod him just a bit. "You know that the Palestinians are saying you attacked a neighborhood without provocation." Friedman scoffed. "I could have written their press release for them before the operation was even launched. It's the same lies every time." "Yeah, I know," Kennedy answered with well-feigned sincerity. "The only problem is," she thought, "that they in turn could have written your press release for you. You know the timing of this is very bad." There was a long pause, and then Friedman asked, in an agitated tone, "How so?" Friedman's frustration was not lost on Kennedy. Her Israeli counterpart was an unusually blunt man, but something in his voice told her that he was under a lot of pressure. He had his enemies in the cabinet, doves who wanted to disengage and start real peace talks. She was sure they were none too fond of this current operation. "The president is meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia next week," offered Kennedy, "and the main topic of discussion was going to be a renewed peace initiative in the Middle East. But now that we have dozens of Palestinian women and children being pulled from the rubble, the whole thing might be a non-starter."
"Irene, it was a damn bomb factory!"
"And it has taken the president months just to get the Crown Prince to sit down."
"You know as well as I do," spat Friedman, "that the Crown Prince will never support real peace. The day he recognizes Israel is the day he ignites the revolution in his country and slits his own throat."
"You think we don't know that?" asked Kennedy, maintaining her neutral tone. "The president wants assurances on other fronts. We want to see a real crackdown on the terrorist groups operating out of Saudi Arabia. We want to see the funding of these groups stopped."
"Irene," Friedman interrupted her and let out a sigh of frustration, "we've been over all this before. I appreciate the efforts you make on our behalf, but this is our war. We are on the front line. We are the ones facing terrorist bombers every day. We will not sit on our hands. When we receive solid intelligence, we are going to act. And if these cowards insist on hiding behind women and children, then so be it."
"Ben, I am well aware of your difficulties, but you can't go it alone. You need to do a better job of keeping us in the loop."
"I am keeping you in the loop," he replied earnestly. "What do you think I am doing right now?"
Kennedy was not about to let him know that she knew he was lying to her, so she simply said, "You're calling me 9 hours after I put a call in to you stating that the President of the United States wished to know what was going on." Kennedy let the statement sink in and then added, "Now come on, Ben, you and I are veterans at this. There's only a couple of reasons why you wait that long to return a call, and none of them are good from where I'm sitting." Kennedy listened intently while she pictured Friedman squirming on the other end of the line. Finally, he said,
"There's something I've been working to confirm. Something that's very important. I didn't want to call you until I knew for sure."
"And what is that?"
"This goes no further than you."
I don't want you telling the president until I can verify it. We had intelligence that a high-level meeting was taking place last night.
How high?
I'll send you the list, but suffice it to say that there were key players from Hamas, the Popular Liberation Committee, Force 17, Islamic Jihad, leaders of the Mahdi Brigades, and possibly Mohammed Atwa, the head of Palestinian General Intelligence.
You're serious? Kennedy acted surprised.
So the story about the bomb-making factory is
true. We did not know it was there. Our rockets set off secondary explosions that were unavoidable.
Kennedy wondered why it had been such a struggle for Friedman to tell her about the real intent of the operation and why, according to her facts, he was still lying to her about the bomb factory. When will you have confirmation on who was taken out in the strike?
By tomorrow I should have a good idea. I have an asset posing as a cameraman who's photographing the dead. Those pictures, along with the intercepts we're picking up, should give us a fairly complete list. Listen now, said Friedman, reasserting control. I have to go now. If I find anything else out, I'll let you know.
All right.
Before she could say goodbye, Friedman was off the line. Kennedy sat there for a moment, staring at the handset, trying to separate the fact from the fiction in an effort to discern what the head of Mossad was up to. In the end, it could be nothing more than his inability to play things straight. There were plenty of people like him in the business, never tell the whole story, only parts of it. Or it could be much deeper than that. Kennedy would have to monitor the situation closely. Turning to her computer, she fired off a quick email to Jake Turbis that she wanted him to personally look into the events in Hebron and do so without the aid of Mossad. She wanted clean, untainted facts by which to judge Friedman's honesty, or, more likely, lack thereof.
Chapter 44 Ben Friedman sat on the porch of the house, sipping a glass of water and looking out at the rolling terrain under the moonlit evening sky. He desperately wanted a drink, but one had not been offered to him. It had been a very long day trying to manage the situation in Hebron. There were people in his government who didn't appreciate the victory he had achieved. They were weaklings, men and women who didn't have the stomach to fight for the preservation of Israel. The man he was waiting to see had the determination, though. The ranch in the Jordan Valley belonged to Prime Minister David Goldberg. Goldberg, the head of the conservative Likud party, had been elected by an overwhelming majority of the Israeli people, despite the fact that his party held only a handful of seats in the 120-member Knesset. That had been 2 years ago, when the people had seen how duplicitous the Palestinians were. The Israelis extended the olive branch, and Yasser Arafat took it from them and slapped them in the face. He used the new Palestinian Authority to secure his hold over the Palestinian people and bring in weapons and explosives to help wage an even bloodier war against the Jews. All the while, he feigned a lack of control over the so-called martyr brigades. Goldberg had been swept into office as a hardliner who would crack down on the Palestinian terror groups and restore some security to the country. Unfortunately, things had not gone as planned. They were up against a new form of terror, one that so far they had been unable to stop. The steady stream of homicide bombers had crippled Israel's fragile economy and frayed the nerves of even some of the stoutest patriots. The martyr brigades needed to be stopped, and Ben Friedman was willing to be every bit as ruthless as the enemy to get the job done. He was worried about his old friend and current prime minister, though. There had been signs lately that Goldberg was beginning to crack under the pressure. His cabinet was filled with backstabbers, and even his own party was asking if the old general had what it took to deal with the crisis. And then, on top of that, the damn Americans were giving him orders to back down. Friedman had seen it all before. He understood the visceral hatred the Arabs felt toward him and his country. In Friedman's mind, it was based on jealousy. The Arabs and their closed patriarchal society couldn't handle being bested by the Jews. The Palestinians had held on to this land for thousands of years and had done nothing to improve it. The Jews came back to their homeland, and in one generation, turned much of the arid landscape into plentiful farms and orchards. They had tried to negotiate a fair peace, but the Arabs would have none of it. There would always be a large and influential segment of the Palestinian people who would never be satisfied until Israel ceased to exist. It was Friedman's job to make sure that never happened. This was the important mission of Friedman's life. It was his vocation to make sure Israel survived, and he was willing to go to great lengths to ensure success. Doing it alone, though, was not possible. He needed help. He needed allies who would pacify the bleeding hearts in his country, those naive imbeciles who actually believed that peace was worth risking the entire security of a nation, of a people who had narrowly avoided extinction. He needed lobbyists in America to lean on the right people, people who could get to other people who controlled the lifeblood of politics, money, people who could deliver the three states that every presidential hopeful wanted, New York, Florida, and the crown jewel, California. He needed America's support more than ever, and he would work diligently to make sure it was there when the time came. Right now, though, the thing he needed most was a strong prime minister who would stay the course. He'd seen signs lately that his old friend was losing his stomach for the fight. This could not be allowed to happen. Prime Minister Goldberg needed to hold true to his commitment and stave off another attack from the liberals. David Goldberg stepped onto the porch, holding two bottles of Gold Star beer. He handed one to Friedman and apologized for making him wait. Even though Friedman would have preferred a stiff drink, he took the beer and watched his friend take a seat in the rocking chair next to him. On the face of it, Goldberg was the most unlikely hawk you would ever meet. His plump, fleshy appearance made him appear too soft for a war hero. He had a mane of white hair, which framed a tanned face and heavy jowls. He was a large man, but not muscular, and it was easy to see him as the grown-up version of the pudgy kid in school who was always picked on. This was a mistake. The man's temper and valor were legendary. Never one to shy away from a fight, Goldberg had the disposition of a bull. He had distinguished himself many times on the battlefield, and for that at least he had the respect of his countrymen. Unfortunately, though, his valor did not indefinitely guarantee their support. Goldberg took a swig of beer and said, "Ben, you have created quite a stir." Friedman listened to a dog barking in the distance and said, "Don't I always?" "Yes, you do, but these are delicate times." Friedman already disliked the tone of their conversation. "When haven't they been?" The Prime Minister disagreed by shaking his head. "We have never seen the international pressure we see now." "Forgive me for being so blunt, David, but the international community can kiss my ass." "Believe me, I share your feelings, but we cannot ignore them. What you did last night is causing me problems." Friedman looked away from his old friend and took a drink from his beer. "David, you asked me to hit back, and did I ever find a way to hit back? It will take them years to recover from this." The Prime Minister wasn't so sure anymore, not since these she-devils started blowing themselves up. More and more, Goldberg was starting to think in terms of withdrawal from the West Bank and the occupied territories. There were only two things that prevented him from doing so. The first was the settlements. Thousands of Jews had moved into the areas and would die rather than leave. The second reason he wouldn't support the withdrawal and recognition of a Palestinian state was that he feared for his life. The man sitting next to him on the porch, along with many others, would have him killed if he were to gamble so recklessly with Israel's security. Knowing he had to be careful with how he dealt with Friedman, he said, "The attack was the crowning achievement of your career, Ben." Goldberg held out his bottle for a toast. "Thank you." Friedman clanged his bottle against the Prime Minister's and said, "But?" Goldberg finished his drink and in a confused tone asked, "But what?" "Don't protect me, David. Remember, I hear everything. I know your cabinet is furious with the number of casualties." "They are rarely in agreement on anything." "Well, if you'd like me to address them, I am more than willing."
Goldberg considered this for a moment. It wasn't a bad idea. Ben Friedman could intimidate even the staunchest opponent. Maybe later, but for now, I am more concerned about explaining to the international community how so many innocent civilians died. He was tempted to remind him that the Palestinians living in the neighborhood were hardly innocent. But the Director General of Mossad decided against it. Goldberg the warrior had transformed into Goldberg the politician. Instead, he said, "They are an unfortunate casualty of war." "But 16 Hellfire missiles, Ben? What were you thinking?" Friedman shrugged. "This was a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I wasn't about to let a single one of them escape if I could help it. I've been told your infiltrator had enough explosives in those cases to take out everyone at the meeting." Friedman was more than a little surprised that Goldberg knew about the specifics, but he covered it well. He had intentionally told him little prior to the mission, with the tacit understanding that if things went wrong, the Prime Minister would have deniability. Now someone within his own agency was talking to the Prime Minister, and Friedman would have to find out who. "David, don't tell me you've lost your stomach for this." A scowl formed on Goldberg's face. "Don't confuse the issue, Ben. I'm hearing things from other sources. I'm hearing that you went overboard on this thing, that we could have avoided killing all the innocent civilians." Friedman stopped rocking and looked harshly at his old friend. "Do me a favor and stop calling them innocent. They have been blowing up women and children for years, and you know as well as I that the only way to make them stop is to hit them harder than they hit us." Goldberg wasn't so sure anymore. When he'd been a young tank commander, he'd thought so. When he'd taken the reins of the country just a few years ago, he had thought so. But now, after all the homicide bombs, he was wavering in his conviction. "Ben, these are delicate times. The eyes of the world are upon us." Friedman was disgusted by what he was hearing. He was tempted to tell Goldberg to step down if he didn't have the Constitution to see it through. Instead, he said, "The eyes of the world have always been on us. It shouldn't matter any more now than it has in the past. We are not the aggressors here, David, and you know that. They are the ones who have continued to attack us, and both of us have been around long enough to know the only thing they respond to is force. But it has to end at some point. We need to find a way." "What?" snapped Friedman. "Do you want to pull out and build your stupid wall? Have you paid no attention to history? All you will be doing is giving them land that they will use to someday attack us from. You will be remembered as the Neville Chamberlain of Israel." "I am talking about doing no such thing," replied a terse Goldberg. "And don't sit here and lecture me about being Neville Chamberlain when just last night you killed 100 innocent women and children. I've been briefed by the army, Ben. I know there was no bomb factory. Those people did not need to die." Friedman did not intend for this meeting to head in this direction, but he was not about to back down. "I will admit that some of those deaths are regrettable, but again, only a few. The overwhelming majority of the people who were living on that block were either terrorists or supporters of terrorists. I will lose no sleep over my decision, and I will gladly stand before your cabinet and defend my actions." "It is not the cabinet that I am worried about," snapped Goldberg. "It is the UN, and it is the Americans. If they decide to look into this and they find out that there was in fact no bomb factory, you will have done us great harm." "They will not look into it," promised an irritated Friedman. "I can handle the Americans. I always have, and I always will, and as far as the UN is concerned, they are a bunch of impotent dilettantes. A week from now, this will all be forgotten." Friedman took a swig of beer and confidently added, "I can promise you, this will all blow over. Right now, though, we need to stay on the offensive. In the wake of an attack such as last night, they will make mistakes. They will seek vengeance, and we must be ready to pounce. This is what I propose we do." Goldberg rocked in his chair and listened as the head of Mossad laid out his plan for how to keep the various Palestinian groups on the defensive. The Prime Minister was torn as he listened.
The old soldier in him very much wanted to press the advantage, but there was another voice in his head that was preaching caution. It was the voice of a politician who had the support of less than half of his country. So far, the only reason he hadn't received a vote of no confidence was because there was no clear challenger willing to step into the ring. His opponents were circling, though, and it wouldn't be long before they pounced. For the time being, he would have to keep a close watch on Friedman. If the UN found out what had really happened in Hebron, his cabinet would turn on him in a second, and Israel would once again be forced back to the peace table with weak leadership at the reins of power. Chapter 45. It was Sunday night. It was late, and Mitch Rapp sat awkwardly behind the wheel of a sedan, his body contorted in such a way as to keep his right butt cheek from touching the seat. Medically speaking, the ass was not a bad spot to be shot. No vital organs, just a lot of muscle and fat. In terms of general comfort, though, it sucked. To the amusement of Coleman and his men, Rapp had flown all the way back from the Philippines, either standing or lying on his stomach. With the mission a complete success, and Rapp's long-term health not an issue, the men were able to make light of his situation. For the most part, Rapp took the ribbing well. The humor was at least a welcome distraction from having to dwell on what awaited him when he got home. Relationships, he was finding, were tricky things. He'd already learned that often his recollection of what had been said or promised varied greatly from his wife's. He'd been searching his memory for the last day, trying to remember if he had ever specifically promised to stay out of situations where he might be shot. Most of these conversations were vague by nature of the secrecy that went along with his job, but he seemed to remember some reassurances he'd made that he wouldn't do anything stupid. Something told him that she would classify getting shot in the ass as downright moronic. Ultimately, however, he realized that this legalistic approach, while an inventive defense, was worthless. Nothing specifically had ever been agreed upon or said, but there were clearly expectations in place. Anna was not a judge or jurist, so any case pleaded on the grounds of technicalities would be unwise. She was his wife, and no amount of truth or logic would save him from her wrath. This briefly led him to the conclusion that he would need to stall and fabricate a story. The Anderson family was currently recuperating at the Naval Hospital in Pearl Harbor. Rapp had told Kennedy that he wanted to stay with the family for a few days and handle their debriefing. He was hoping to stretch the debriefing into a full week of recuperation for his own tender wound. In addition to that, he felt it would be fairly easy to fake a surfing accident on a coral reef. All he'd needed to do was shred a pair of swim trunks and scrape himself up with some coral. It would hurt like hell, but it would pale in comparison to what his wife would do to him if she found out he'd been shot. Kennedy had dismissed his request immediately, saying that something had happened in Israel and she needed him back in Washington immediately. A plane would be waiting for him in Pearl Harbor, and he wasn't to waste a minute. Ever since that conversation, he'd been struggling to find a way out of an impossible situation. Somewhere over the western United States, he'd come to the awful conclusion that he would have to face the wrath of his wife head on. This was all new to him, this feeling of dread. Relationships for Rapp had always been fairly uncomplicated. Since the death of his college sweetheart, he had never allowed anyone to get that close to him. Part of it was his job. Intimacy involved honesty, and his job precluded allowing any woman to really know him. There had been a torrid affair with Donatella Ron, an Israeli spy, that had lasted on and off for several years. In certain ways, Donatella knew him better than anyone. It was a volatile relationship, prone to great highs and depressing lows, and in a certain sense, they were too much alike to ever marry, although she sure would have liked to have tried. There had been plenty of other relationships, but never one so serious as to make him want to change. Anna had altered all that. Before her, if someone asked too many questions or demanded too much of him, he found the nearest exit and never looked back. Relationships had always been easy because they were always on his terms, and as soon as those terms were challenged or questioned, it was over. Now, Everything was different. There was no walking away, no my place and your place. It was now their place. He had married Anna because he wanted to spend the rest of his life with her. She made him want to be a better man, and deep down inside, he knew it was for all the right reasons. But right now, driving down this dark, rural Maryland road, he dreaded seeing her reaction. In a way, he hoped she would lash out at him and get it over with. The alternative was too painful to think of. Anna was a fiercely stubborn woman. The worst thing she could do to him was withdraw her love and affection. Rapp turned into their driveway and swallowed hard. He'd called her earlier in the day when they'd landed in California to refuel and told her he'd be in around midnight. It was now closer to 1 o'clock, and he hoped she would be asleep. The front porch light was on, but that was about it. Rapp parked on the new pad next to the single-car garage so Anna could get her car out in the morning if she left first. Carefully, Rapp rolled out of the car seat and stood still for a moment. Every time he placed weight on his right foot, it felt like someone was sticking a knife into the wound. The doctor on board the Belleau Wood gave him a pair of crutches that he'd left at the airport. This whole shot-in-the-ass thing was going to be handled on a need-to-know basis. And Anna was the only one who needed to know. As far as everyone else was concerned, he'd pulled his hamstring. After grabbing his bag from the trunk, he limped over to the front door like an invalid. When he inserted his key, the dog began barking. Rapp opened the door and quietly greeted his mutt. "Hi, Shirley." Rapp patted her head and then keyed in the code to turn off the alarm. Somewhere in the house, he thought he heard music playing. Anna had left the small light over the kitchen stove on, but other than that, the first floor was dark. In the faint light cast from the porch, Rapp saw a piece of paper sitting on the stairs. He picked up the linen card and opened it. It was addressed, "My dear husband, I've missed you terribly. Hurry upstairs." Looking at the note, Rapp let out a long sigh and then started gingerly up the stairs, his left foot taking each upward step carefully followed by his right. By the time he reached the top step, he could tell the music was coming from the bedroom. He approached the open doorway with trepidation, torn between a deep yearning to hold her in his arms and the fear of how she would react when she discovered his wound. The room was lit with candles, and there she was, lying in the middle of the bed, in a black silk nightgown propped up against an array of plush pillows with one leg languidly crossed over the other. She gave him a devilish smile and held out her hand. Rapp's brain was racing in opposite directions. Part of him wanted to tear off his clothes and jump into bed with her, and another part of him was saying that he needed to explain a few things before he got naked. For the short term, the path of least resistance and most enjoyment won out. Rapp moved across the room, smiling at his gorgeous wife. Stopping at the side of the bed, he reached out and held her hand, and for a moment, all of his worries melted when he looked into her sparkling emerald eyes. She tugged, pulling him closer. Rapp bent at the waist, only a few inches, and was instantly shocked back to reality. The fresh wound stopped him in his tracks, sending signals screaming to his brain not to bend farther. Rapp recovered by pulling Anna toward him. She got up on her knees and wrapped her arms around his waist. "I missed you, honey."
"I see that," replied Rapp as he cupped her face in his hands and kissed her on the lips.
"Did you miss me?"
"You know I did," Rapp smiled, "more than you can imagine."
"Oh, I think I can imagine."
She wrapped her arms around his back and squeezed tight. Rapp held her head against his chest and laughed like a little boy.
"Did you have a good week?"
"No."
Anna reached up and slid his jacket over his shoulders, letting it fall to the floor.
"How could I have had a good week without you?"
Next, she grabbed the leather holster of his Beretta and slid it over his shoulders. The daughter of a Chicago police officer, she knew enough not to let the weapon drop to the floor. Carefully, she lowered it and set it on the jacket. Rapp admired her slim figure under the thin black silk and let his hands begin to explore. Anna tugged at his shirt and began unbuttoning it while she tilted her head back and offered her lips to her husband. Rapp kissed her, knowing he should stop her from undressing him and explain what had happened, but he couldn't.
He didn't want it to stop. Anna tore off his shirt and broke away from the kiss. Pushing herself back, she ran her hands over his bare chest and down around his sides. She took in his lean, strong body and let out a lustful moan. Before Rapp could react, her hands slid from his sides down and around to his butt. Anna looked into his eyes with a playful hunger and squeezed with a force that matched her passion. There was a split second in Rapp's mind where time stood still. Everything froze, and his mouth and eyes opened in anticipation of what was about to happen, and then the pain emanating from Anna's grip shot through his body like a lightning bolt. His entire body went rigid, and he reached for his wife's hands. Prying them loose, he stepped back and closed his mouth and eyes as a wave of nausea washed over him. "What's wrong?" asked a startled and concerned Anna. Rapp held onto her hands and waited for the pain to subside. In a weak attempt to lighten the situation, his painful expression lessened into a grimace, but not quite a smile. His brain searched for the right words, but they weren't coming. "What's wrong? What did I do?" Anna stepped off the bed, holding her hands out gently. "You didn't do anything," Rapp managed to say. "It's just something that happened to me."
"You're hurt?" Anna looked confused. "Why didn't you say something to me? What's wrong?"
The questions kept coming as she moved closer, and he backed away in a weak attempt to buy some time. "Honey, it's not a big deal. I just suffered a little injury while I was in the Philippines."
"What kind of injury? Let me see it."
Rapp held onto her hands. "No, you don't need to see it. It's no big deal." Anna detected the look of guilt on his face and seized upon it.
"What do you mean I don't need to see it? I'm your wife."
"Honey," Rapp said in a lame attempt to calm her, "it's really no big deal." Anna released him and took a step back, placing her hands on her hips. With a menacing look, she stared him right in his face and said,
"You are trying to hide something from me, Mitchell Rapp, and you'd better come clean right now, or we are going to have serious trouble."
Rapp let out a nervous sigh. He was boxed in with nowhere to go. Defeated and embarrassed, he said, "I was shot during a hostage rescue and..."
"Shot?" screamed Anna. "Oh, my God, where? Are you all right?"
Yeah, I'm fine."
Concerned and puzzled, Anna asked, "So where were you shot?" Rapp hesitated and then, in a slightly embarrassed tone, said, "In the ass. But don't worry, I'll be fine. It just hurts a lot." Confusion spread across her face. "How did you get shot?"
"I can't talk about that," Rapp replied with as much confidence as he could muster. "It's classified."
Anna placed her hands on her hips and looked angrily at her husband. "Classified my ass. You're my damn husband for a week. You come home one night and tell me you have to leave town on an urgent matter and that, oh, by the way, you won't be doing any more of that James Bond stuff that you used to do."
She stabbed a finger at his chest, backing him into the corner.
"You lie to me, Mitchell."
"No," Rapp kept his hands out in front of him. "That's not true, honey.
Don't bullshit me, Mitchell. And then to add insult to injury, I run into your boss at the White House on Friday night, and she tells me you're over in the Philippines, supervising the rescue of that family of Americans. Irene told me you were on some ship and out of harm's way."
Folding her arms tightly across her chest, she added,
"I can't believe I was dumb enough to trust her."
Rapp was completely caught off guard that his boss had confided in his wife. Shocked, he asked, "Irene told you about the mission?"
"Yes," Anna got right in his face. "And don't try to change the subject or hide behind all that national security crap. If you want this marriage to survive, you'd better come clean with me right now. How in the hell did you get shot?"
There was no more room to maneuver. "I was shot during the hostage rescue."
"So you weren't on the ship? You were right there in the thick of it?"
After hesitating for a second, he said, "Yes." Anna began shaking her head. Through clenched teeth, she snarled,
"That bitch, she lied to me."
Looking her husband in the eyes, she said, "Your boss sat there and lied to me at the White House. She ordered you to lead this hostage rescue and then had the audacity to tell me you were safe." She clenched her fists and let out an angry scream.
"You're done working for her, and when I see her, boy, am I going to let her have it."
This ends Disc 7.